August 10th, 2020. Hope all is well with you and yours. Me? No complaints. Took out my smokeless grill last night. Little breakfast for dinner. Had not had bacon in a while. Hey, in case you don't know, bacon tastes good. Today's guest is a treasure, a testament, an example of how we all can rise above whatever inconveniences are hindering us. John O'Leary, JohnO'LearyInspires.com, knows his place in the universe, and if need be, can help you find yours. We've got Jack Buck stories, Joe Buck insight, a fun trip down memory lane at Humphreys, and, well, let's get back to John in a minute. In sports, no Cardinals. I doubt they come back this year. College football presidents meet this week, sense the same fate as the Cardinals. Blues, winless in their first three games. I kind of like their chances if the refs can swallow their playoff whistles. Trump, without Congress approval, signed a new unemployment stimulus of $400 per week, but states are on the hook for 25% of that. That's $100 a week per unemployed American. Have you seen how many states are already in the red? I'll let you connect your own dots. Three things you should if you have not. How long has it been since you made a good omelet? Lord knows we've got the time. Works best on a griddle, couple eggs per omelet. No milk, especially if you're adding cheese. I'm a fan of Cabot's mac and cheese. Like a good burger, leave the omelet alone. I like to not mix meats and vegetables, but that's your call. Before you fold, throw in a tab of butter. Extra bonus, unlike scrambled eggs, omelet leftovers taste just as good reheated. Number two, rewatch the Breaking Bad movie El Camino this weekend. If you've never seen Breaking Bad, it's a standalone B. If you have watched Bad, A+. How has Aaron Paul not found another vehicle? Did you see who Jesse Pinkman writes a letter to in that last scene? I'm so looking forward to Better Call Saul Season 6, but alas, COVID is going to take a little longer than we had thought. So if you are new to this podcast, welcome, Overtimer. That's what we're going to call you. Feel free to hit that little subscribe button that's at the top. If you are a listener and haven't yet, when you do that, that gets me in front of more ears, and I appreciate that. Also, this episode actually is also on YouTube. So if you want to watch it, you can go ahead and go to YouTube, search OT with Oliver, and you can see the episode online. A little something different. Moving on, number three, JohnO'LearyInspires.com. Look, I get a little squeamish with life coaches, but John's not one of them. Or if he is, he's good at it. John's got great stories to go with his philosophy. Despite doing 300 podcasts of his own, probably guest on another 100, speaking in front of millions of people, give or take, I think we talked about some stuff that you can only hear right now here. Come on down, St. Louis and DeSmet alum, John O'Leary.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
And now it's time for another episode of Overtime with Oliver, OT with Oliver. Today we are speaking with John O'Leary, local speaker, author, podcaster, globally known for his inspirational story, and more importantly, his inspirational perspective on life. Good morning, John. It's 8 a.m. where I am. How are you?
Zeus, I'm doing awesome. So David Oliver, it's great to see you again and to be your friend.
8 a.m., that's a first for my podcast. I think I'm going to throw myself under the bus. What have you already accomplished this morning before we met?
Well, man, I got out of bed, so that's ball one. So I'm vertical, and I say that kind of tongue in cheek, but I think it's underrated. Many of us just take our lives for granted. We take where we live for granted. We take the breath in our lungs for granted. We take the ability to worship or not for granted, to speak or not for granted, and I don't. As you know, David, I've been through a couple of events in my life that have kind of challenged me to wake up and recognize all that I have and all that we have. And so I got up this morning a little before 6 o'clock. I make a coffee early. I go out to the screen porch. I watch the sunrise. It's my time to kind of meditate, reflect, pray, sometimes journal, and start my day off listening to nature. We live in Webster Groves, so the St. Louis listeners know where that is, but all around my home are these trees. And I don't know if we have Missouri monkeys in our trees or what, but they make so much noise in the morning. And so I try to go out there, not with podcast on in the early morning, not with the television blasting in the background, not with the technology plugged in. I go out there only with a journal, only with a pen and with a cup of coffee and listen. And there's a lot to take note on in the morning.
You know, John, we're going to talk about the two books. The first one, On Fire, The Seven Choices to Ignite a Radically Inspired Life. You got the new one, In Awe, both bestsellers. And in my podcast, a lot of times I'll have a guest who's got a story, and I almost kind of avoid it because it's already out there. I can't avoid your story, so we'll get to it. First of all, you mentioned that you were born in St. Louis. What'd your folks do?
My mom was a school teacher before she had, I think, her second child. And by the time I came along, I was number four. She was staying home almost full-time with me. We ended up having six O'Leary kids, so I'm one of six. My dad is an attorney. He worked in construction law. He worked at a small firm called Dubail Judge. And then eventually at a larger one called HOK. It's a large architecture firm downtown. We grew up in Town and Country. Right at 270 in Clayton Road, had a golden retriever, had a wonderful upbringing. And David, as you know, and all your listeners know, sometimes you don't even recognize the blessings you have as a kid. And so I had such an awesome upbringing that I'm not sure I recognized as a kid how spoiled, how special, how remarkable that time was.
Grew up a Cardinal fan?
Well, you must have missed it. I grew up in St. Louis. So that should definitely answer that question. And I grew up in the 80s. And the heat was indeed on in the 80s. So yeah, I am and was a huge Cardinal fan.
Mischievous kid growing up, question mark.
Yeah, so I think being born male, again, kind of answers that one. I think most little boys have a mischievous streak. I have three of my own today, and I recognize they have some of their dad's same qualities or lack thereof. We were at a newer neighborhood, and it was the kind that had construction site being done all the time, and with the encouragement of some of those construction guys, we would borrow some wood. We would build these wild tree houses in our backyard. We would play cops and robbers all the time on our bikes. We just had a blast, man, growing up.
So as we get into it, statistically speaking, you probably should have died in January of 87.
Yeah, unequivocally, because on January 17th, 1987, I was involved in a house fire, burned on 100% of my body. 87% of the burns were third degree. And the way they decide mortality these days is they take the percentage of your body burned. They add your age and they've got mortality. So in 2020, that same little boy has about 109% likelihood of dying. So way back, man, before electricity, back in 1987, this little guy had seemingly utterly no chance of surviving. And yet you and I are on the podcast today.
When I read about the story, I think you owe a lot to Susan, your sister.
Man, I owe a lot to everybody other than myself. A lot of folks who interview me assume that I'm a mountain climber. And they assume I can teach you how to put your left foot in front of your right and get to the very tippity top and look at how great you are. You've made it. That's not my story at all. I think that's a valuable story for many, but it's not mine. I have been carried my entire life, and we could spend quite a bit of time on a whole lot of the Sherpas, the leaders, the servants, the volunteers, the parents, the pastors, the rabbis. Got letters from President Reagan, Pope John Paul II. Trees were planted in Israel. It was a global movement of people loving and praying and encouraging this little boy. But the one you brought up, my sister Susan, man, I'm in the front yard of my house. It's on fire. The flames are leaping through the roof line. I have burns, you know, on 100% of my body. Everything is gone, man. Everything is gone, including my clothes and skin. It's a very scary sight. I'm 9 years old. I don't think I want to live at that point because I'm in so much pain and I'm in so much fear. It's a dramatic moment. And my sister, Susan, she's just turned 8 years old. She knows what I'm going through. She can hear me screaming out of pain. And then I tell one of my other sisters, just go back into the house, get a knife and kill me. Just kill me. This is too much. I'm not going to make it anyway. And this little girl, rather than getting a knife, she goes into the house. The house is on fire, David. She goes through the front hall, the family room, into the kitchen. She gets a cup of water, runs back outside. She throws it directly into my face. After she throws the first cup of water in my face, she turns and she goes and she gets a second cup, risks her life, and then she throws it in my face. And then she runs back into a house a third time. And we think it's another miracle. There are many within our stories, but this is another one that this little young 8-year-old dark-haired girl is able to risk her life three times safely for the life of her older brother. The water that she threw, by the way, all of it hit my face and scalp and my entire body. For those of you who can see me, I'm burned from my neck to my toes, third degree. But my face is not. My face is really one of the only parts of my body not burned third degree. And it's the doctors who credit her with cooling the skin temperature just enough that instead of third, it was only second degree burns. It's important for my radio face. So that's one thing it's important for. But more than that, it's really important because they took all the skin from my entire body, from my scalp. So when you're burned third degree, they have to take skin from somewhere. And they found it, in my case, on my scalp. And they credit her with providing that harvest site.
Two-part question. Does she have kids?
Susan has 5 kids.
So she has unlimited babysitting, courtesy of you, whenever she wants.
Man, she's got unlimited anything, as do the other siblings. The reality, man, is much has been made of John O'Leary, and I'm grateful and humbled by it. But the real heroes are the ones that are not on your podcast today. They're the ones who are with me in the front yard that morning. They're the ones that grew up without a mom and dad because my mom and dad were with me. And so, like, yes, I will babysit for my siblings. That's true. But I'll do a lot more than that for them.
On this podcast, I've heard a lot of great Jack Buck stories. Take your time as long as you want, John. Let everybody know about you and Jack Buck.
So I listened to your Randy Carricker version of a great Jack Buck story. And Randy's a great man, a great voice, and a great friend. And one of our mutual friends is Jack Buck. So Jack Buck was, for the listeners who grew up in a cave outside of St. Louis, the announcer for the St. Louis Cardinals for more than 4 decades. And part of that stretched the 80s. That's when I was hottest into baseball. And he was the voice I listened to every single night growing up, Jack Buck, and his pal Mike Shannon. Well, I got burned on January 17th. I was later on that day in a hospital bed, tied down, can't move. I can't talk because there's a trach cut into my neck, forcing oxygen into my lungs. And the swelling was so intense, David, that I can't see. So I'm 9, I'm alive, I'm in there, but I'm unable to do anything other than feel and dream and pray and listen. You know, listen, that's important. You know, this is foreshadowing. The following day, I'm in that same bed. It's a Sunday morning. I barely made it through the night. And then the door opens up. Somebody walks in. It turns out that it's the great Hall of Fame radio announcer, Jack Buck. He sits down right next to me and he says in a voice that only Randy Carricker can do, but I'll try, kid, wake up. Wake up. You are going to live. You are going to survive. And when you get out of here, we are going to celebrate. We'll call it John O'Leary Day at the ballpark. And then he says, kid, keep fighting. And I'll be done with Jack Buck for a while. So you can all be grateful for that. He stands that day. He walks out of that room. And that's the end of my Jack Buck story. This man comes in one time, encourages me, walks out of that room. I'm inspired forever. I'll never forget that visit. It's a moment I'll never ever forget. I learned later on, though, that he made his way down away from that room, 3 doors down, leaned his head against a glass door, and just started weeping. And one of the nurses comes over to him and, you know, acknowledges it's the Hall of Fame announcer himself, Jack Boggs. So she kneels down, tries to comfort him. And he says, that little boy won't make it, will he? And the nurse acknowledges that there's no chance at all that the little boy is going to survive. There's utterly no chance whatsoever. And even though he received the diagnosis, and even though he'd never met me before, and even though he'd already done his bit of good, you know, he went once, that's enough. For whatever reason, it's hard to explain, but for whatever reason, he comes back to the hospital the following day. He sits down next to me, and I can't see him. You know, my eyes are swollen shut. I can't feel them. I'm tied down to a hospital bed. But I hear the voice say, kid, wake up. I'm back. You are going to survive. You are going to live. Keep fighting. Keep fighting. And so begins this game of cat and mouse, Jack and John, that continued for the 5 months that I'm in hospital. And when he went down to spring training, late February, early March, he would send people in his place. Andy Van Slyke apparently was injured that fall. So Andy Van Slyke became a visitor. There was an old football Cardinal coach. Apparently there was a football team in town called the Cardinals. Wide receivers would swing by. Stomp Mitchell would come by. Gene Stallings, the great coach, would come by. hockey players started swinging by all because Jack Buck, someone everybody respected, kind of tapped them on the shoulder and said, hey, I have a kid. I have a friend. Would you swing by and say hello for me? So Jack was a dear friend to me during those 5 months in hospital, and he kept the promise of John O'Leary Day at the ballpark.
You've got an autographed baseball from Ozzie Smith with a really nice story behind it.
Yeah, it's all, you know, we think the world revolves around us. Little do we know, it revolves around the sun. And as big as the sun is, it's one of what I think 300 billion stars in the Milky Way. And the Milky Way is part of a couple hundred trillion, they think, galaxies in the universe. And so although your life matters, and I really do mean that, it's important to have a little bit of measurement and humility when we look in the mirror and we think it's all about us. What I know is I'm not here without a lot of the work that a whole lot of people did, and Jack Buck was part of that team. Jack Buck had seen at John O'Leary Day at the ballpark how little I could do with my hands. You know, my body's burned terribly from my neck to my toes, so I'm still in a wheelchair. I can't stand. I can't move. My fingers had been amputated, so I can't hold anything. And he recognizes that although the little boy is alive, he's not really living. And there's a difference between the two. We could spend several hours on that one. There's a difference between being alive and really being alive, really living, really being capable of doing things. So this phenomenal announcer sees this little boy with no fingers, sees a little boy with a smile on his face watching baseball. And the following day in my mailbox, there's a baseball signed by Ozzie Smith. And below that ball was a note from Jack that read, hey, kid, if you want a second baseball, all you have to do is sign a thank you letter to the man who sent the first. So although I had not yet written a note to anybody, how could I? I don't have fingers. That day I screamed for my mom, was panicked. I said, Mom, get me a pen, get me a paper. And with her help and the help of a therapist, we put my hands together, wedged that pen between my two hands, wrote a note to Mr. Smith, mailed it off, and a couple days later, I received a second baseball with a second note that said, kid, if you want a third, and kid, if you want a fourth, kid, if you want a fifth. And if we were doing this podcast instead of my office at my house upstairs in my son's room, his name is Jack, by the way, you would see 59 baseballs, 59 baseballs that were sent 33 years earlier from a guy named Jack Buck, who really had no business visiting me in some hospital bed, and certainly no business sending me 60 baseballs as we progress forward in our friendship.
Did he keep the notes?
Did he keep the notes? I don't know. Did I mail him the notes from him. Yeah. Dude, this is a shocking story, but my mom and dad had a second fire, and everything that we had that was meaningful in many regards, letters from Pope John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and all 60 letters from Jack were lost in that fire.
So John, you do a lot of speaking. Are you like more than 2,000 talks, right?
That is right.
So here's my question, and it's really just a question for me because I'm curious. When you give your speech, when you tell your story, have you added things to it or change things about it because of the feedback you got from your audience as you continue to tell the story?
So yes and no. As far as truth goes, absolutely not. So I refuse to use poetic license on, you know, Jack sent me 250 baseballs just to make it better. No, it was 60. It was 60. And I have 59 because my fat golden retriever dog ate one when I was in eighth grade. So that's where the extra one went. But we have 59 today. We probably have 58 with three little boys, and one of them might have made its way outside. But I remain very, I think truth matters. And in the marketplace we currently reside with, hey, this isn't a political statement, it's a statement of fact, where people will use the truth in very nuanced ways to bend it toward their will. I don't think that's healthy. I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it's attractive. And so the truth of the story, the way the story rolled out, has remained completely the same for the last 16 and a half years I've been doing this. What I have done, you said, John, have you taken feedback and changed the story? Absolutely. Absolutely. As far as how I deliver the story. So 2,000 times in, if you had met me when I gave my first speech to three third graders in St. Louis County, if I was giving that same speech now, it would be to like two Boy Scouts in St. Louis County. It would have shrunk in size. It would not have elevated. The reason it has grown and continues to grow is because humbly, we keep getting better at our craft. We add in more humor. We add in longer pauses. We end more sentences with question marks. We have it built out in a completely different, more life-giving manner, because in the early days, I thought the speech was about me. Look what I did. Look what I went through, and look what I weathered. Now I recognize the story is not even about Jack Buck, because for a while I thought, well, it's about others. It's about Jack and the nurse Roy and my mom and dad. Gosh, they were great. But it's not really about them either. It's ultimately about, in my faith view, what God has done for us, how he has given us the gift of life, and how we can use that life for a cause so much greater than we currently are. It's a love letter, if you will, to the audience members on how they can have an even better, more effective, more meaningful life going forward, in spite or maybe because of what they've been through. And so the story has changed profoundly, only in so far as I can speak to the hearts of the individuals in the room.
How did the book Overwhelming Odds change your life?
Yeah, dramatically, because we never talked about the story. When you come out of the hospital, David Oliver, you don't dream of going back in, and you also don't dream of sharing something that happened to you that you thought was tragic, and the world viewed as tragic. I mean, geez, I don't know if there's much worse outside of death than a child being burned on 100% of their body, but just it's about as dire and as gory and as tragic as it gets. And so that's the way we viewed it for a long time. And then at about age 27, my mom and dad wrote a book about it. It's called Overwhelming Odds. And they put a picture of me on the front of it. It's the first ever unauthorized biography of John O'Leary's life. I look forward to the next one. Let me know if you want to write it. But they got all the details right. And so as I'm reading this book, I'm reading fact and truth. And it's the story of my life. And it blew me away. It's good. And I got to the end of it, two things happened. Number one is I recognized what I went through wasn't the tragedy I had always assumed it was. It was painful, but it was a blessing. And I just never stopped to recognize it as such. The second thing is I'd always viewed that the event as happening to me. I had never once imagined what it was like for my siblings to lose their home, what it was like for three little kids to wake up to the sounds of screams and to see their brother standing with flames leaping off of him in the front hall. What's that pain like, not only then for children, but today as adults? It's pretty tough. What's it like for mom and dad who had normal lives to get a phone call to say your son's in the hospital room, to race there, and then to see him in the condition that I was in? And then every single day afterwards, wondering when they came back the following day, would their son be there for them? Like, what's that pain like? So I'd never viewed the story through another person's lens. And in doing both, and seeing my bad as good, and also seeing the empathy of someone else's experiences, it allowed me to see the reflection in the mirror that for the first time maybe ever was worthy of being embraced and worthy of being loved and a story worthy of being shared. And not long after that is when a little Girl Scout said, hey, she called my cell phone, hey, Mr. O'Leary. So I said, I think you're calling for my dad. Let me give you his home line. She's like, no, it's you. I want to talk to Mr. O'Leary. So she shared with me what she wanted to do, bring me out to her little troop. And at that point in my life, I was able to say yes. Had she called 6 months earlier, no way.
You mentioned the notes that Jack used to leave you and the notes you used to send to Jack. When was the first time you got a note from somebody who you didn't know you were helping?
I would imagine there were a couple even before I started to really share the story. But there, the second speech I gave was to a Rotary Club. You know, the 31, usually it's older, seasoned people in the room, great hearts, great minds, trying to collect the best of their lives in service to a cause greater than themselves. So it's a wonderful organization. But I received a letter after that second speech from a gentleman who, I won't even go into the specific takeaways, but he referred to what happened after hearing me speak as a miracle in his life. This was my second speech, and it's like, wow, you know, I wasn't paid for that. I got maybe a chicken lunch as part of the compensation for a Rotary, but it made me realize maybe this is about something that is so much bigger than John O'Leary or some business opportunity. Maybe we can start changing the world one life at a time, and letters matter, whether they're being handwritten by me or received by others. The idea of having someone in the world who takes the time to send a love letter your way, a gratitude letter your way, it's kind of passe these days. It's gone out of touch a little bit. But if you want to set yourself apart, listeners and viewers, write letters, write them every day. Watch what happens.
Graduated from DeSmet in 95. That had to have been tricky.
Well, many levels, and probably not for the ones you think. Let me back into the story like this. I was signing books. You know, I wrote a book called On Fire, and I'm signing books in Nashville, and I'm looking at the lady in front of me and signing her book, then the gentleman behind him signing his book. And then I look up and it's my English teacher from sophomore, junior year in high school. And he just gives me this big hug and has this huge grin on his face, because we both realize as he's hugging me and as I'm hugging him, how unlikely this whole thing is. And the reason I say that is not because Jack Buck heard about me and started sending baseballs or something. I struggled mightily in school. I struggled in grade school. I struggled at DeSmet. I went on to St. Louis University, but I was not an all-star student. So I've kind of tripped my way forward in life academically, including during those 4 years at DeSmet. So yeah, I struggled writing a little bit with hands and typing a little bit without fingers. But the real thing I struggled with was focus. I have ADHD, although it's undiagnosed. Man, it's there. And today I'm grateful for it. I had no interest at that point in schoolwork. I had far more interest in weekends, in girls, in cars, and things like this, and nature and baseball. That's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to spend 9 hours a day behind a desk in school. So I struggled, and graduation was a gift. Unfortunately, it led right into freshman year of college. And eventually that would lead itself to my professional journey. So no rest for the weary. But you look back sometimes in life and you recognize, gosh, I wish I had been a little bit more committed. Because today I love learning. I love reading. I love subjects, man. I love astronomy. I love history. And back then I was almost purposely doing as little as I could to get through. That's such a mistake.
You took your time at SLU.
You know what, man? That's a joke I sometimes make. I took my time. I took 4 years. To me, that seems to be reasonable to graduate college with a double major. So, but even back then, David, I majored in things that my older fraternity brothers were saying would get me the most money. Not passion, not mission, not heart, not faith, not praying over, just job. Get a job that will pay you. And so I majored in IT. I hate computer science, man. Majored in IT programming and finance. And neither were my passion then, and neither are my passion today. And I'm grateful that as a senior in college, my poor mom and dad, as a senior in college, probably late November, right before Thanksgiving break, I'm interviewing with one of the big firms. And this lady interviewing me, starts talking about the job I'm probably going to get, and the travel involved, and the 5 nights out per week, and I'm going to become a consultant, and all this stuff. And I left that interview and realized, man, that's not what I want. I don't want to miss a whole baseball season. I don't want to be away from my family and friends. I don't want to figure out where the nearest dry cleaner is when I'm out of town so I can get suits, you know, fixed when I'm gone. And so I started thinking and reflecting and praying over that over the holidays. And that's when I bought this old beat up house in Soulard for the St. Louis listeners. Soulard is this cool, a lot of 2-3 story brick homes, most of them built in late 1800s. So I bought an old brick 6-family home that needed major work. And I'm a guy without fingers. I'm a guy who had never done painting my own bedroom, let alone an entire structure. And one of my college buddies and I started a firm here in St. Louis. And one by one, we started fixing up properties. And that was my excuse to avoid adulthood for a little bit longer. I did that for about 10 years.
When I graduated from Mizzou, I got a lot of cool presents. I did not get a Hall of Fame baseball from Jack Buck.
Well, apparently he only had one, and he's for whatever reason decided to give it away to somebody else. And it's one of the most remarkable stories. And I'll back into it by saying when he passed away, there were, I think KMOX ran 3 hours of call in with your Jack Buck story. 3 hours. Think about that. Can you imagine if they could give 3 hours of people eulogizing you? That was the idea. It went on for 3 days. I mean, that ought to move you. 3 days of people calling in, whether they're in retirement homes, prisons. The man liked to visit people everywhere, not just burn centers, apparently. But for whatever reason, he visited a kid in a burn center and locked onto him, became his friend. And I never even called in when Jack Buck passed away. So they never heard his story from me. And they never heard it from anybody else either, because nobody knew it. one of the best things about Jack Buck is he did not do things to get the credit for it. I think so frequently these days, and this is not a knock against celebrities today, but it is a reality. When they arrive on the scene, the cell phone is recording. We're live on Instagram. Let's go see these kids with cancer. Follow me in. Hey, Billy, I'm back. Get the kid. That's what's going on right now. Very frequently, Jack had no cameras. Jack did not tell Carol. Joe Buck doesn't really know about the relationship with John outside of what he's learned in the years that have followed. Jack came and Jack gave because he knew he was called to it. He knew it mattered. And so when John O'Leary graduated college, Jack shows up, no limelight, no media, no attention. And he gives me the most priceless gift that he has professionally. It's this heirloom, and it ought to be in Joe Buck's trophy case. I mean, candidly, it really should be with Joe. And he gives it to a 22-year-old college drunk kid that has no clue what to do with it. He wrote me a note that day that said, kid, this is the baseball that I received when I went into the Hall of Fame. It's made of crystal. It's priceless. Don't drop it. And then the final words he spoke to me this side of eternity were, it's yours. It's yours. So, man, what a gift to give a child. 22, you are a baby. That had no idea what to do with generosity like that other than to awkwardly look up and say thank you and awkwardly write them, you know, a two-paragraph thank you letter the following day. Thank you.
When you first started to do the speech, did you have a hard time not choking up?
Man, I get a hard time not choking up today. I think it's even more real now in some regards than it was then. And the reason for that is I don't view the story as mine. Like, I'm not all that broken up by me. For me, I think I am the luckiest, most blessed guy I've ever met. So when I get emotional talking about physical therapy or talking about bandage changes or talking about Jack Buck, it's not me I'm emotional for. It's the fact that I know what it's doing to one listener. And a few of your listeners might be yawning as they put toast in the toaster and get on with their day. But there's somebody listening right now who is profoundly moved. And I think about her, I think about him, I think about them, I think about where we are as a society right now, how fractured we are, how isolated we are, how broken so many of us are, how 1.5 million of us last year attempted suicide. Like, that's what I'm feeling when I get emotional. So I get very emotional today when I tell this story because it is a story about life, And I want to tell it well. I want to do it justice and I want to inspire others to do their life even better. So for me, I take that very seriously. Back in the early days, I think I was emotional a little bit because the story's rich and it's good, but more emotional out of anxiety for how you might feel about me. And that's the total wrong thought process to carry into a stage. Ultimately, you should not care at all what someone else thinks about your hands, your words, your suit. Do your shoes match? Is your zipper up? All this garbage, man. If it's about that stuff, we all lose. If it's about how we're moving hearts in the room, we all win. We all win. It's a collective victory. And so I used to have a lot of anxiety around how people felt about me. And now I don't. I care far more about how they feel about themselves and their life.
How did you meet Elizabeth Grace?
I met her at a fraternity party my junior year, her freshman year. And dude, there are moments in life that you see in movies where the music starts playing in the background. And you're like, that is so cheesy. That crap never happens. And yet that cheesy crap happened in my life. I saw her. I was immediately drawn to her. She's gorgeous. I told her that night she looks like a much prettier version of Jackie Kennedy. And I think Jackie Kennedy is gorgeous, man. She's a stunning lady. And fell head over heels with her that night. I pursued her about a year after that first meeting. I asked her out. And she sweetly said to me, John, I'm sorry, you're like a brother to me. Which was the most offensive thing I've ever heard in my entire life. And the only time I heard something more offensive than that was the following year when I asked her out a second time and she had the exact same sentence back for me. So I was her brother for 3 years before eventually she came to her senses. She took me out to dinner and she asked me out.
And so John, people with impairments always say, treat me just like you would treat anybody else. So I'm going to act like we've been friends for 10 years. Dude, you outkicked your coverage.
Oh, man. Look, I'm the first one to admit it. And I not only outkicked my coverage with Beth, but with life, with success, with where I live, with who I know, with the journey we've been on. The whole thing is about outkicking your coverage. It's all about grace. All of it is about grace. And I recognize that in my life. We in our most recent book, we did a study on how likely it is that you are born. And I think most of us are like, well, of course I'm born, man. Look at me. Hey, oh, Phil, I'm here. Yeah. How unlikely it is that you have the genes that you have. Really, like, have you ever thought about how remarkable it is that your mommy and your papa, whether you like it or not, whether you want to think about this or not, that they got together right at the right moment to lead to David Oliver and John? Like, have you ever thought about how remarkable that is? So the math is this. If you look at all what your mother brings to the table and all that your father brings to the table, it's less than one in 400 trillion. It's almost incalculable. And then when you add in the fact that the same math applies to their parents, now it's you've completely lost the ability to run this math out, this calculus. Your life is a gift. And so I believe in God. If you don't believe in something divine, though, in something profound that has given you the blessing of life, I don't think you've really thought through how remarkable it is that on a rock a couple hundred million miles away from a burning set of gas, you find yourself doing life listening to a podcast on your iPhone today. Like, it is utterly stunning. And so I just challenge you to do some research, kick the tires, poke around a little bit, see what you come up with. My faith is in Jesus Christ. It's strong. It's rich. It has helped me weather some very difficult days. But I do encourage all of us to be reflective on not only outkicking the coverage in our dating relationships, which John O'Leary most certainly has, but also in your life. We're in the game, and that ought to blow us away every time we think about it.
How did you propose?
On my right knee, man. On my right knee outside of Cafe Napoli in Clayton.
Nice.
When we had our first date, she took me to a restaurant. And, you know, she's a college senior. She doesn't have any money at all. She takes me to Cafe Napoli. We sit outside. It's a gorgeous September day, September 12th, actually. And she asked me out. And at the table right behind us is a guy named Mike Martz. So I remember the day for a couple of occasions. This was back in 01. The greatest show was on the turf. The sun is shining. Beth O'Leary is asking me out. It was a remarkable day. And then about 3 years later, I took her back to that same restaurant. She said, you know, you better ask me. You better have the question one of these days, John. And I had this big old rock in my pocket. It's like weighing me down to the right side. But I wanted to do it outside of the restaurant at the same place that she asked me out. So we stood up from that table at the end of dinner, walked toward the car. And then I said, oh, wait one second. And she turned around. And when she turned around, I was on my knee.
Nice. Did you do the podcast before On Fire or after On Fire?
So On Fire came out 4.5 years ago. And I started the podcast about a year after that. And the idea, you know, the way I view branding for people who are trying to grow their own businesses or following whatever that is, it's always to ask yourself, what do our followers need? What would make a difference for them? Not how do I get bigger? How do I make more money? How do I make myself look cooler so my kids might actually like me? None of that garbage, I don't think, really ultimately matters. That stuff might happen if you pursue the other thing first. How do I serve the ones that we're trying to impact and inspire? And so it began with speaking, and that was really effective. You can inspire 50 to 100,000 people at live events every year. That was great. But then, okay, how do I scale that? What if you wrote a book? Awesome. How do you get this even bigger? Well, what if you start a Monday morning newsletter? Awesome. Engage in social media. Beautiful. But eventually, it's how to bring in people who have even better stories than you. Let them tell their story like you're doing with me right now. Just let them long story form. And hopefully there's something in there that connects with the listener. And so we've done this now. I think we're 300 episodes in. And I've had people that you would have never heard of ever who are remarkable, and people who are truly well-known, truly remarkable, who remind us that we can be truly wonderful and remarkable too by loving the one in front of us.
When I looked into your podcast, and I apologize, I had not really gone into it before setting this up, I found it interesting that Mel Robbins is the most listened to podcast, and it really has a lot to do with her 5-second rule. Can you tell people what that's about?
So I think it's several things. One is there's some synergies in our audiences. So it'd be like, why do the Cardinals and the Blues always hang out together? Why is their leadership always partying together? They're doing auctions together. Well, there's synergies. And if you can bring your fan base together, both grow. It's not a mutually exclusive game. It's not you win, I lose. It's win-win, which ought to be a lot more of what we're trying to do in society. I'm kind of done with the cancel culture. We could spend a whole nother podcast on that. We cannot cancel one another out. Life doesn't work that way. If it does, it's going to get violent. Instead, we've got to sit back and listen, come together and create win-win solutions. So it's an important tenet that we believe deeply in. You asked about Mel Robbins' 5-second rule. She's got a rule and she's got some science behind it that says anytime you're making a decision, like should I get out of bed early or hit snooze? What she recommends you do is you count backwards from 5, 4, 3, all the way down to 2, 1, and then lift off. And then in that countdown, it gives you a moment to make that excuse, but it also gives you the opportunity to say, and I'm going to choose better. It reminds you ultimately that you are in control of your life, not the news, not the alarm clock, not the dog down the street barking, not the headwind that's blowing in your face or the economy. No, you are in control of your life. And so the idea is to move toward launch with that sequence.
And you're right. Phenomenal guests all across the board. I'm going to highlight 2. 1, you've got the autograph Ozzie Smith baseball. He's your hero growing up. What's it like to be sitting across and interviewing your boyhood hero?
Yeah. What I love about Ozzy is he's genuine in every setting. So when he was doing flips onto the AstroTurf, the interviews you would get from Ozzy were authentic. Like he wasn't pulling a whole lot of punches. He wasn't being someone he is not. He's in Alabama, I think Mobile, Alabama. He spent a lot of time in California, got traded to the Cardinals maybe 2 years into his career, maybe 3, and goes on to have a Hall of Fame career. And yet he has a very level head on his shoulders. That is highly rare for wildly successful athletes of any sport. Ozzy's a good guy. And so to be across from a guy who shook my hand on John O'Leary Day at the ballpark, and then 33 years later, shakes my hand again at the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. And he treated me the same when I was 9 in a wheelchair as he did when I was 33 as a man across the table interviewing him. So just very inspiring and very remarkable to be with a guy I think we can look up to as someone to respect.
So if folks have not heard the podcast, it's Live Inspired, correct?
It is the Live Inspired podcast.
I listened to the Ozzie Smith podcast. I thought it was great how he talked about his mom. Mm. I listened to the Joe Buck. Joe Buck, by the way, does your intro to the podcast. And here's what I love about the concept I have for my podcast is longevity, things in time. You interviewed Joe Buck in 2016. And at the end of the podcast, you ask them 7 questions that they fill out on a piece of paper. One of the questions that you ask is, if you inherited $1 million, what would you do with it? And as God is my witness, Joe Buck says, I would work to help the mistrust between inner city and law enforcement. Hmm. Isn't that a little prophecy?
You know, so I don't remember that answer, and I wish I had. Now that you brought it back in front of me, I'm going to not only listen to that podcast, I think it's one of the best ones we've ever done. Not because of my great questioning. Joe is another... He's a straight shooter. He's funny. He's smart. He's charismatic. He's professionally wildly successful, but he's never forgotten where he came from. And I know a lot of your listeners are from St. Louis or listening because they love our community. The reality is this, man, Joe could and maybe should live in a whole lot of other communities that would make his life easier. Chicago would give him better airports to fly out of. The coast would give him greater access to bigger media source, all this stuff. So for the haters of Joe Buck, ask yourself, why is he living in your backyard? Why is he still wearing his Cardinal jersey? Why is he still celebrating and investing in his community? Why is he still trying to say, if I got $1 million, what would I do with it, man? I would send money to bring out the best of our law enforcement and our kids in the community, because he cares. He cares a lot more than those who are just trying to cancel everybody else out. So let's make sure we celebrate the heroes that are choosing to live in our backyard. And I think Joe Buck is one of them.
I don't know anybody else who's ever interviewed William Hung.
It's funny you say that. Last night I was jokingly singing that song while brushing my teeth and driving my wife crazy. So she bangs, she bangs. And, it's not the finest song or rendition of it. Who's the guy who sang it originally? Ricky Martin, I think he originally sang it. William Hung did an incredibly poor impersonation of it that became part of American Idol lore. And so he was so horrifically bad that Simon has never forgotten it. And by the time the show finally went off the air, the final talent, the final act they brought back to sing in front of Simon was William Hung. So we brought him on to talk about that song, talk about that impact. But what it really was is the world was laughing at William Hung because he was so bad. And so the audience laughed, Simon laughed. Every cable channel covered it the following day. It went viral in a mighty evil way. The deal is, though, most of us are too afraid to step onto the stage. We're very good at hanging out in our parents' basement talking about how lousy the GM for the Cardinals is, the Cardinals' shortstop is, upper management is, the Deutsch don't spend enough money. We're very good at tweeting and texting about how everybody else doesn't do their job well from the safety of our parents' basement. That's where most of us are doing our great work. Well, this guy went on the stage in California, and with everything he had, he sung with every single fiber of his belief in his body. And they laughed him off the stage. But I think the real story is the courage to go, man, the courage to go. And so I celebrate courage, man, courage. And you don't need to be a Hall of Famer. You don't need to make it to the upper echelons of owning a baseball team or becoming the GM for the Cardinals or playing shortstop for the team to have an awful lot of courage that you can put on display. I have recognized in my life, David, that the greatest heroes were not the ones with their jerseys, with the names on the back of their jerseys, but with their names on the front of a name badge. They're custodial staff. They work in grocery stores. They deliver milk. They're, in quotes, the least among us, who are the most important among us. They do the work that keeps the rest of society going. And I think if we can show up mightily and do great work there, that's not something to laugh at. It's something to celebrate and applaud. And that's what I was trying to do with the William Hung interview.
On your website, that's a great story, by the way. On your website, you've got a list of some of the clients that you work with. And one of the things that jumps out is the diversity of the people that have hired you to provide motivation or inspiration. One thing that jumped out on me, you work with Starbucks companies. Do you know Roger?
I do.
Nice guy?
Roger's a very nice guy. The laugh is because you cannot be, and I'm going to get his rank wrong, and for the trollers, you can knock me later on. I believe he was a captain, maybe in the Navy.
Right. He was in the Navy.
You don't become a captain in the Navy. You don't serve overseas. You don't become the quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. And then you don't go on to become the owner of a multi-billion dollar business without having some toughness about you. Some high expectancy of what is possible through your life, but also in the lives of those that you are going to partner with, whether they're the guys you're serving with in the Navy, the offensive lineman covering your rear end, or the guys that you're going to partner with professionally. One of my favorite Roger stories, early in his business, he had two brokers. He's in real estate. Two brokers coming together, fighting about the same commission. So David was saying, well, he's my friend. And O'Leary's saying back, yeah, but I'm the one that knocked on his door. So they're fighting about who's going to get the $5,000. This is the very, very early days of Staubach & Company. And Roger listens. He asks a couple of questions. He finally says, hey, can you guys figure this out? And they both say, no, Roger, we can't. That's why we're in front of you. And he says, okay, perfect. I've got to figure it out. We're giving the entire commission check to my favorite charity. Don't ever come to me with this crap again. And that's the last time in that organization there were ever brokers who fought about a commission. So the idea is this, guys, you're big boys, man. You're leaders now. Act like it. Figure your stuff out. Figure it out as friends, as people, as leaders. Don't bring this garbage up to me because I'm going to make it go away in a way that's not going to help either one of you.
Love it.
So that's the way Roger leads. He's a great leader. And so his family's all involved in the business still.
Well, I'm having a blast. I knew I would be. Let's make sure we don't wrap this up without talking about the new book, In Awe, released in March. Again, a number one seller. Walk me through the 21-day challenge.
So for the folks who want to learn about it, they can go to readinawe.com. So it's just simply readinawe.com. It's free. 21-day challenge is there. The idea was COVID-19 began whispering back in January and began roaring in February and really kicking the tires in early March. So as an organization, recognizing what this looked like it was going to do to our economy, to the challenges that are dividing so many of us already, to being isolated. Cigna ran a study in 2018, and what they recognized is that 56% of Americans felt isolated. This is when none of us were isolated. And it was having all kinds of mental health blowback and the fact that we felt as if we were doing life completely on our own. And so our organization, we have a team called Live Inspired. recognize that, man, we got to do something that makes a difference for those who are struggling, those who feel as if they're by themselves, and for those who are dealing with despair and feeling like there's no reason for hope. So we worked on 21 days of simple challenges that people can step into to recognize there's reason for hope. There's a step you can take. And the truth is they are not alone, and the best days are in front of them. And so we rolled this out in middle part of March, and we've had tens of thousands of people go through it. It's just a cool life-giving free program that reminds people that life is still good. Life is still good.
I don't want to give away too much in the book, but here's a little nugget I found very interesting. Everybody knows about the five senses. You know, you got your smell, you got taste. You've come up with an idea of five new senses. I'm going to read this: wonder, expectancy, immersion, belonging, and freedom. That's some pretty powerful thought behind that.
Yeah, well, and there was never a thought that I had that hasn't already come by someone far smarter than me in years before. So one of my favorite quotes from the Bible is, and it's 2,700 years old at this point, and the quote is, there is nothing new under the sun. And it's from the wisest man in the world. He's just like bummed out. He's like, man, everywhere I look, it's all been done. It's all been said. Nothing new under the sun. That was true 2,700 years ago. I think it's still true today in the era that you and I live in. So nothing new under the sun. But I borrow those senses and just observing my children. What I was witnessing, David, is that we adults were like, many of us are disengaged in our days. We struggle relationally. We're not wild about our job, but that's all right, because in 32 years, we're going to retire anyway. So we got that to look forward to. And I mean, we just kind of get through these days with our shoulders slumped. And that's us. And then you look out and you look at children, and their little shoulders are pulled back, and they don't walk anywhere. They skip everywhere. They seldom frown. They smile all the time. They actively engage with those around them. They do the weirdest things, like ask questions. Rather than building walls, they just keep asking questions like, why is your skin red? Where are your fingers, mister? But as soon as I answer, boom, okay, that's all. Now we can be friends. Like, that's it. And so I wondered, what is it that children have that we adults have lost sight of? And how do we return to that? And so our organization identified five senses that children have. They just naturally have these baked into their DNA. And as we go through school, as we go through losses, as we experience disappointment, we begin to lose those five senses. And you mentioned them. But this idea of freedom is the final one. Belonging, immersion, expectancy, and wonder. It's first time living. And I believe the gift that kids have and the way they view a rainbow or a cloud or an earthworm or a day can be ours again if we choose to see life through first time living.
It's all about living bravely.
Correct.
All right. So I'm going to turn the tables a little bit on your podcast. We talked about Joe Buck and the questions. You have a live inspired seven. So as we wrap this up before we do my St. Louis seven, John, what is the best book you ever read?
Probably The Return of the Prodigal Son. I went in a million different directions that you, as you first asked it, but you know, I like On Fire, In Awe quite a bit. There's a whole lot of leadership books I love. There's a great spiritual book called 12 Ordinary Men, written by a guy named John MacArthur, talking about how ordinary the apostles are, and maybe you and I can become great in our lives as well. But the reason I picked The Return of the Prodigal Son, it's just the story about a kid. It's a parable from the Bible about a kid who runs away from his dad, does everything stupid under the sun. And I feel like that son very often. I've done everything. I've made every mistake under the sun. And then it's a story about this dad who is always looking for the son to come home. And while most of us would have some angst or judgment, the father, and that's who we are called to become in this book, the father just runs and greets this boy and loves him where he is. And the whole book, written by a guy named Henry Nouwen, it's taken from a painting that hangs in St. Petersburg in Russia, where it was painted by Rembrandt. And Rembrandt painted The Return of the Prodigal Son twice in his life. The first time at the height of his success, and the second time at the very end of his life. His wife had died. He'd lost three children to death. He'd lost his wealth. He'd lost his fame. And he paints this picture one more time. And at the very end of his rope, it's the most magnificent picture he's ever painted. I think it's 6 foot by 4 foot hanging high on this wall. And it's this wonderful dad just hugging this boy who's come home so broken. And it reminds me, first of all, I can come home. We all can. And secondly, not only can we come home, but we are called to be looking for people who are broken, Joe said, if I got $1 million, John, I would try to bring two challenged communities together as one. That painting reminds me, not only is that our calling, but it's possible. It is possible.
The third question you ask, and I find the wording on this interesting. Your house is on fire. All living things and people are out. You have the opportunity to run in and grab one item. What would that one item be?
Right. So as you know, from the question you asked earlier, it draws its question from my sister going in for water. So that's what she gets. But the idea, of course, is that the listeners will be far more, or the interviewees will be far more thoughtful. So they may not get water. Many of them get cell phones. Many of them get laptops. Many of them get pictures. But I frequently hear from others, then I'll give you my answer, others that it's like one lady who runs a $1 billion business. She ran in and she grabbed a plastic cross, like a plastic cross that she has on her vanity in her downstairs bathroom. I'm like, that's an unusual thing to grab. Why'd you get it? And she grew up in absolute poverty, generational poverty. And yet her mother used one of the checks to go out and buy a plastic cross, this little baby plastic cross. And it sat in their kitchen growing up. And so when her mother passed away, the one thing she took from her mother was this plastic cross that now graces her vanity. And I just think sometimes it's not the most valuable things you grab. It's the most priceless things you grab. And so for me, if I were to tell you what I would get, it's actually maybe not what you're thinking. I would let the baseballs burn. I'd let the checkbook burn and the laptops burn. I'd make sure the kids and the dog are out. But I would actually get a journal that I wrote for my wife. So during that year when I launched the book and launched the podcast and was busier ever than professionally, I also wanted to be focused on the things that mattered most personally. So every day, starting January 1, 2017, I would write one love letter a day to Beth, acknowledging one beautiful thing she did that day, just one thing. And I didn't tell her I was doing this, but every day I would just add on to a January 2nd, January 3rd, January 4th, dear Beth, things we did together, things she did for the kids, things she wore, experiences we had. And on Christmas 2017, I gave her this gift. And I've never made my wife cry happy tears before in my Christmas gifts. She's cried many sad tears, but never happy tears. But that day she was actually happy. And it was one of the best gifts I've ever given her. But the reason I love it so much now and the reason I would run in and get it is even now, she reads it. It's something she returns to. We laugh about. We had friends die that year. We had great experiences that year. We took vacations that year. In other words, we did life that year. And that brings her back to both the low points of the year and how we got through it, but also all these shared beautiful experiences we had as a couple. And so if I came out, I'd have this old, ugly, coffee stains, wine spilt, frayed, leather-bound journal with love letters to Beth.
John, you just made a whole bunch of us look like schmucks.
Well, man, I've been a schmuck every year since. So that was 2017, 3 years ago. It's time to start writing again, O'Leary.
All right, last question I ask you is the last question you ask your guests. It's been said that all great people can have their lives summed up in one sentence. How do you want yours to read?
You know, you would think after asking 300 times, I'd have an answer ready to rock and roll for you and a good answer at that. I'll stumble into this by letting you know two things. Number one, I think about death all the time in a very life-giving way. And so I think most of us either ignore it because it's scary or try not to think about it because it just reminds you how finite life is. And so we don't want to think about that. It's spooky. For me, it's jarring. I don't want to miss a thing because I don't know if tomorrow's promised. I have a body that reminds me every time I stare at it that tomorrow is not promised. But what all of your listeners and you, David, should recognize is your tomorrow is not promised either. So we should be very thoughtful in how we want to live because death is the only promise. That is the only promise. So I want to live boldly. I want to live faithfully. I want to live lovingly. But if you ask me what my one sentence is, there's an old, I think it's in Jeremiah, the scripture that says something to the effect of seek justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. Seek justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. If I could have people around my gravesite sharing these stories of love and laughter, the crazy things we did together, the experiences we had, but they were ultimately saying, you know what, Dan, if I had to summarize his life, the dude just sought justice, he loved mercy, and he walked so humbly with God. That would be awesome.
John, I had a ball. I hope you did too.
David, it has been a ball. It's been a blast. It's been an honor as well.
And another one for the books. John, appreciate you, man. Good talk. All right, so don't forget, if you have not yet subscribed to the podcast, just hit that little subscribe button, whether you're on YouTube or whether you get your podcast. This Thursday, another fantastic talk. I had a ball with this one. Coach Rich Grauer and his son Brian. We talk about St. Louis. We talk about St. Louis basketball. We talk about SLU. We talk about a lot of great stuff. Mark your calendar, Thursday. So, as we do, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.